When you hear or read about the American-led, rules-based, liberal international order, do you think, yes, that's important to me and my grandchildren, and it needs to be sustained at all costs? Or do you agree with the recent front-page article in the Wall Street Journal that reported, with no hint of disapproval, that China and its allies are no longer obliged to conform to a U.S.-led global order? Or do you think, what global order? I don't see any global order. These are just a few of the questions I'm eager to pose to Kurt Volker, who has served as U.S. Ambassador to NATO and is a leading expert in foreign and national security policy with over 35 years of experience in a variety of government, academic, and private sector capacities. Also joining the conversation is Reuel Marc-Gerecht, resident scholar at FDD, whose previous career was in the CIA's Directorate of Operations. I'm Cliff May, and I'm pleased you're with us too, here on Foreign Podyssey. Well, Ambassador, welcome, and thanks for virtually coming in. Listen, a few updates that seem to me to be related. I'm going to just tick off. One, on Thursday, March 30th, that's the day we're recording, full disclosure, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said China is seeking a new international order with Beijing as the dominant player. Encouragingly, I think, I'm not sure, I'll let you decide, she added that the European Union must be more assertive in defending its security and economic interests. She said the EU needs a strategy for de-risking, her word, its relationship and dependencies on China. She also tied the future of Europe's links with China to Beijing's actions in Ukraine and effectively called for a halt to remaining hopes of enacting a 2020 EU-China investment agreement. So she's talking about China's backing for Russia in this war. Another thing she said, the Chinese Communist Party's clear goal is a systemic change of the international order with China as its center. So as I understand that, she's telling Xi, if you're giving guns to Putin, you're not going to be the EU's BFF. Now, also today, there are reports that China and Brazil have cut a deal to ditch the American dollar and trade in their own currencies. Those reports are not solidly confirmed, best I can tell. But China, not the U.S., is Brazil's biggest trading partner now. And one component of this liberal international order, the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency. That's something I want to come back to, why that's important, good for us, good for others, and whatever else you have to say about that. And then there's this. The Saudi government also just approved partial membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is a political and security bloc. It includes China, includes Russia, includes India. I see this as a poke in the eye to Joe Biden. But I can also see why Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman would see this as a move in the Saudi national interest. So all that on the table. And before we go to these developments, let's back up a minute. Let's spend just a minute on ancient history. Reuel loves ancient history. Then we'll go to modern history. Ambassador, there's always been an international order of some sort, even if people are unaware of it or not. I mean, isn't that the case?
Yes, absolutely. You can go all the way back to the days of the Roman Empire, Napoleon, or the concert of Europe. You know, you can say anything, and you say there's some form of international order. What I think is important to get at is values, and this has not been stressed enough. I think your lead-in was great, but by saying it's an American-led or a Chinese-led international order, we're missing the point about, well, what's different about that? And what's different about it is values, where we're in a struggle. Humanity has always been in a struggle to establish forms of governance where people are in charge of themselves. There's freedom. There's protection of people and their rights. You can make a living for yourself and your family without it being an unfair and unjust system. You don't have a knock on the door in the middle of the night and people come and just haul you off. So it's this idea of freedom, democracy, market economy, rule of law, values-driven international order. So happens that the U.S. is the strongest player in this, and we have a lot of allies, and we all work together, and we all have a stake in this. What China is doing is it is rejecting the values and saying, we don't want that. We want to be an authoritarian dictatorship. We don't want our people to have freedom, and we don't want to have to deal with other countries that are on the basis of value systems. We just want money and trade, and we're going to be the biggest player in that. So this is what this is really about.
So I agree with that. I think the word liberal is meant to be shorthand for the values when they say liberal international order, because what China wants, what Russia wants, what I think the regime in Tehran want is a distinctly illiberal international order, and they want to replace the liberal international order with the illiberal one. Before we go on, do you want to say a word about Pax Romana, about the Roman imperialism, how it wasn't liberal, it maintained peace, prosperity?
I think the most important point one should highlight is the United States' construction after World War II was not imperial, in the sense that we had voluntary associations, primarily between the Europeans, whom we saved, and the United States, that then extended into East Asia with Japan and then Korea. And that, you know, in the past, even with the British, the orders that were maintained had an enormous level of coercion. Democracies hang together voluntarily. Sometimes democracies will have dictatorships as allies, but there's always tension, there's stress, much more than you'll see between democracies hanging together. And, you know, obviously the United States, NATO, the Americans and Europeans have had stark differences, but still those things that bind us are stronger than those things that separate us.
So let's, if we can, dig in a little more to the creation of the current international order, agreeing that in the past, the international order was, generally speaking, established and maintained by empires, because, I mean, empires, that's the way the world was organized throughout most of history. People don't realize that, I talk about the British Empire, the French Empire. Yeah, but the Ottoman Empire, there were always empires. If you were an independent nation state that didn't want to be an empire, you would probably get swallowed up by an empire and you could rebel against that empire, but you'd probably be unsuccessful.
Well, there was no conception of the nation state.
Well, yeah. I mean,
that's later.
True. Although the Jews, the ancient Jewish nation wasn't trying to establish an empire. It was trying to keep free a bit of the Roman Empire. They rebelled, and of course they lost.
They did have an imperial moment. It's just that the resources for that imperial moment were not really substantial.
What was the imperial moment? I didn't, my Jewish
no,
history.
No, no, no. You actually you had a moment where the Jewish state started to expand, except it simply didn't have the resources to do that, and there were other bigger boys.
And there were bigger boys on the block.
Much bigger boys on the
one
block.
One after another, basically. Yeah. Okay. So, all right, moving to modern history, let's talk about it. So my understanding is that Roosevelt deserves a lot of credit for the creation of this. As early as 1942, he was thinking about, what kind of post-war world do I want to create, and how would it be a more peaceful one, less likely to have wars as we've had in the past? And he was not somebody who liked the idea of empires. That was a bit of tension between Churchill and Roosevelt always, right? And he was a little bit, I think, too solicitous or sympathetic towards Stalin, even not quite understanding that Stalin was resurrecting the Russian Empire with different branding. I mean, because the Soviets always said, we're anti-imperialist. But I don't think people in Kazakhstan thought they were anti-imperialist, or Turkestan, and certainly the Baltics. No, they were. People don't always get that. And it was kind of based on Woodrow Wilson's vision to give credit where it's due, because Roosevelt thought, well, I'm going to create something like the League of Nations, but a lot better, because that had failed for various reasons. And among other things, we want to include the defeated in this, not push them out. Versailles was a mistake. It made the Germans more resentful, right? And we're going to include the Soviet Union. They were our allies. I don't think Roosevelt knew that a Cold War was coming before he died. I think that would have been, I think he thought, we're getting along with the Russians, the Soviets, and we will post-war as well. We have a lot in common. On this basis, Roosevelt.
Cliff, if I can jump in on that.
Yeah, go ahead, jump in, please.
Yeah, I think what Roosevelt thought is that spheres of influence are okay. Soviets will have their sphere of influence, we'll have our sphere of influence, Europe will be a sphere of influence. So he thought that would be stable. What he didn't realize is that the Soviets were not satisfied with their sphere of influence. They wanted more and more and more. They wanted to dominate everything. and that they were also, as well correctly pointed out, they were vulnerable to defections within their sphere of influence because people weren't there voluntarily. They wanted to get out of the empire. You know, all of Central and Eastern Europe, that was the case. So I think Roosevelt didn't quite understand that the spheres of influence were not like in nature, and that they would not be stable.
And you know, those who would call themselves realists or retrenchers, who some of us might call isolationists or neo-isolationists, in a sense are they not the exact same argument now by saying, let's let Putin have his sphere of influence in Eastern and Central Europe. Let's let Beijing have its sphere of influence in Asia. Why not? And we'll have this I'm jumping way ahead from where I'm into, but we'll have this multipolar world and we'll all get along just fine. And I think what they don't realize is what you're saying, Ambassador, is no, Xi Jinping is not going to be satisfied if he just gets Taiwan. And Putin is not going to be satisfied if he just gets Ukraine into the Russian Federation or empire. That's not the way it works, except in the minds of people like Mearsheimer at the University of Chicago.
Well, I think you're being too kind in the sense that
I always do that.
I think the isolationist wing of the Republican and the Democratic parties, it's not that I think they think that the world that things will be just fine, is that they just frankly don't care. Mm. So the issue is, what is the responsibility of the United States? What does the United States have to pay? They just soon not bother with it. And so if the other parts of the world go to hell, I think their view, which was similar view that you had in the United States in the 1920s and 1930s, is that in the end, it's not going to touch us, that we'll be okay. So basically, I think we are having to relearn again. We shouldn't have to, given that the world is obviously more interconnected now than it was in the past. And perhaps to some extent, that's what people are rebelling against, is because the world has become so much more interconnected.
I have to point out that it's not only the argument that Xi and Putin won't be satisfied if they take Taiwan and Ukraine. It's also the pesky fact that there are Ukrainians and there are Uyghurs,
yes,
and there are all sorts of other people in these empires who don't want to be there.
Right.
So here's what I see as an important point that of what's going on right now. To the extent we have had since Roosevelt or since Truman, since post-World War II, which a world order, an American-led, rules-based, meaning some international law, liberal, meaning values, international order. It is threatened at its very core if two pillars of it are now broken. And the one pillar would be, one basic pillar of this international order is, you don't use force of arms to conquer other peoples. And there's some sense of human rights. After all, it was the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that was signed as this order was created with the UN. Universal, that means on Mars, Venus, we all agree on this, right? It's not just global, it's universal. So, but we have credible accusations that that Beijing is committing genocide against Muslim Turkic people, against the Uyghurs, with less publicity, I would say, against the Tibetans. And you know, most of the world, the Muslim world, is saying, it's kind of not our problem. The Turkic world is saying it's not our problem. The Africans, Latin Americans, it's not our problem. The Europeans are a little discomforted by it, but, you know.
Well, the Americans essentially say it's not our problem.
Well, no, we do say it is. I mean, you got to give credit for the administration. The State Department released a report last week saying genocide continues against the Uyghurs.
It is, but it's only recently with China has the United States begun to question the proposition put forth by Nixon and Kissinger and then amplified by George H.W. Bush and Brent Scowcroft, and that is that engagement with China, particularly commercial engagement, would eventually soothe the savage beast. And they would become a more normal player in the international system. Deleted from that equation is the fact that fascism can function just fine in a system dominated by capitalism. So it's been a relearning process. We should have known that from what happened with Italy and Germany in the 1930s. We seem to have deleted that from our memory banks. We're relearning it now. But I think for the most part, given the massive Western investment, American investment in China, I think for the most part, we really didn't care all that much about the Muslims in Chinese Turkestan and the Tibetans. That was sort of a sideline issue that, you know, a few CIA officers became passionate about and a few others. But for the most part, it was, tossed to the National Geographic.
Let me – 2 points I want to tease out of that I think are important. One is there was – and I think you can call it a strategy on the part of the West, and it was bipartisan. And I think it started in about 73 with Nixon and Kissinger, that what we need to do about China is engage and bring them into the system and make them good stakeholders in the system, and they'll benefit from the system and they'll like this system. And that probably reached a peak when, I guess in 2001, if I'm not mistaken, Clinton – brought China into the WTO as a developing nation, which means with all kinds of privileges that other WTO members didn't have, saying, you know, can we not be your good friends and we'll help you? And isn't this what you mostly want? And maybe Deng Xiaoping did, but Xi Jinping does not. And so this was a bipartisan strategy. It was a coherent strategy, but it failed. It failed, and the experiment's over. We now know you're not bringing them into this.
I don't know if the Europeans would yet say it's failed. I'm not sure.
You're probably right. They might not, but it has.
I'm not sure corporate America would still say it's
not
failed.
All, yeah.
I think there is some, you know, fuel left in that tank.
Point taken.
I mean, there are a lot of Europeans that I meet who can get extremely passionate about Ukraine and can want to see the Russians defeated. They're much further leaning than, say, the Biden administration is on what we should be doing in Ukraine. But then you bring up China and you can hear the gear shift because, you know, the standard of living in Europe is – I don't know if it's dependent upon Chinese growth, but at least it's several decimal points. So it's a much more challenging situation for them. It's a much more challenging situation for us. I don't think we've ever confronted a situation where I would say we have a rising, really powerful fascist state that we are intimately, economically tied to.
A point taken, but that's why Ursula von der Leyen's point today strikes me as interesting and important, because she is now saying, as the European Commission president, China is a problem. Let's acknowledge that, guys. Okay, and we can't just move ahead with China with what they're doing right now. Especially if they're going to back Putin up more forcefully than they have. That's sort of what she's threatening. Is that not what you hear?
I would agree with that. I mean, I'd be curious, Kurt, of your view of one, do you think the Europeans are solid and will remain solid on Putin? And then imagine a scenario where the Chinese actually start open arms deliveries to the Russians. Just a wild scenario. Let's say that does happen. Where do you think the Europeans go on that?
Well, first off, I think the Europeans are pretty solid against Putin right now, but there will be a point when the fighting dies down for whatever mechanism causes that. There will be a time when it's not just active warfare, and a certain segment of Europeans will say, okay, now we have to get back to a relationship with Russia. They're here. They're a big country. They're a neighbor. We can't have no dialogue. So I think Putin knows that and is waiting for that. So even though they're tough on Putin right now, I don't think that is going to last beyond the fighting. They may still pursue the war crimes issue, but even then that's then, you know, it's going to be something that exists on paper, but isn't implemented. No one's arrested and delivered to The Hague if Putin remains in power. And I think
imagine scenarios where either overtly or covertly Chinese aid to Russia increases.
So let's come to that, because on the one hand, yes, it's a hypothetical, If China did actively weigh in with Russia, I think there would be greater pressure to distance from China as well. So I think that is the case. However, I do want to say, though, I don't think that that scenario is terribly likely, because I don't think it's in China's interest to be siding with Russia in this war in Ukraine. Quite the opposite. I think that they want to reinforce how different China is and Chinese ambitions for Taiwan are from what Russia is doing in Ukraine. And they don't want to tear up their economic relationships with the U.S. and Europe. And they probably even want to make money in Ukrainian reconstruction and build influence in Ukraine through that. So I think it's very unlikely they're actually going to be siding with Russia on this and providing arms. They much prefer being in the position that they're now in, which is Russia started a war. It's a bad one. The United States is now on the other side of this war. And we're an honest broker seen by the world as someone that just wants to figure this out.
And they've reinforced the honest broker image by fostering a detente between Riyadh and Tehran. But they do have a no limits partnership with Putin, and she does seem to like Putin, and he just visited with him recently. I got to imagine that Putin asked for more than she, and she said,
yeah, I mean,
oh,
the part I'm skeptical about is that, I mean, I think she is certainly a believer that politics triumphs over economics. And so, and I think if he is prepared, and I have no idea whether the date that's 2027 that gets thrown out there by a lot of folks, including people at the Pentagon, is a year that we have to worry about them, you know, going for Taiwan. I think it is safe to say you have to be worried about the Beijing going for Taiwan. If that's the case, if they are contemplating scenarios of a military invasion of Taiwan, then obviously there are issues for them that are much more important than economics. If that's true, then also their relationship with Russia could be dictated by those issues, which means that I think there is a scenario where the Chinese either overtly, I think it's probably covertly, substantially increase their support of Putin because they want to see Putin win in this engagement.
No, I think they already see that Putin is losing, and they see him as weak, and they see him as declining. There's basically when I saw the pictures of Putin and Xi standing together, it's very clear that Putin needs China. China doesn't need Russia. And I think when you look ahead, 27 could be a critical year, but the Chinese are doing things and building things on their own agenda, not because of a Russian agenda. And just, you know, to point out, when Xi was in Moscow, the Chinese had the heads of all the central Asian states in Beijing. And I think this was deliberate timing to be showing that they're the big player now in Central Asia, not the Russians. And then we just saw one of the things you forwarded today, Cliff, was Saudi Arabia joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. That's very interesting.
Yeah. That's right. And that, again, I think the Saudis, again, they could not be more. They're hugely angry with Biden. I think that relationship is very badly broken. But they also have very good trading relationship with the Saudis, with the Chinese. The Chinese buy their oil. The Chinese are not, unlike Biden, saying, I'm going to fight a war against oil and other hydrocarbons. I'm going to make them worthless in a few years. All the things that Biden's been doing and saying, as Obama did, I'm pivoting to Asia, means I'm showing my backside to the Middle East. They get that. And they're not, and I know this, I talked to enough Saudis, they do not see Biden. They're not, maybe not the United States, as reliable anymore. And that reliability.
Well, I mean, the Middle East is about power politics. So if the United States is unwilling, and I think it has shown itself to be unwilling, to eliminate or attempt to eliminate the Iranian nuclear issue, then it has demonstrated, despite the fact that it has said repeatedly that it would not allow Iran to develop a nuclear weapon, then the United States has lost an enormous amount of cachet. It's lost its most important point for credibility, which is its military power. So it's quite understandable in my view that the Saudis and others would go to the Chinese because the Chinese do have influence in Tehran. We have none.
All right. So getting back to the liberal international order, if Putin should prevail in Ukraine, and if she should conquer Taiwan, that's the end of the international, of the post-war international order as we know it now. Then it becomes something very different. It becomes illiberal. It becomes rules made in Beijing, authoritarian rules for the world. Again, there are a lot of people who say, I don't see how that should have an impact on us here in the United States. But maybe it's worth talking about why that would have a huge impact on the United States in terms of our freedom and our prosperity and anything else we value. If we say, okay, we're passing on the baton. We were sort of the first among equals for a very long time. Now China will be, we can live with that. What's the problem? And I think a lot of people don't understand the problem. Kurt, you want to take a stab at what that would mean for America, not even the world, but for America?
Well, there are so many aspects to it. Probably the most obvious and immediate one is that it will result in a wider war. You know, we've been through World War I and World War II. We thought we were done with that. But now you have two empires, Russian Empire and a Chinese Empire, reestablishing themselves, whetting their appetites, taking territory, and therefore definitely interested in war. We know the Chinese have claims on pieces of Japan and on pieces of Vietnam and on the Philippines. Russia views the Baltic states and parts of Poland and who knows, maybe even Sweden as historically Russian territories. So they will have greater appetites if they succeed in taking Ukraine and Taiwan. That's the first thing. The second is that China does not present an attractive model to the world right now. But if it grows and grows and is able to effectively create a yuan-based trading system and one that doesn't emphasize values and rule of law, but really is just about money flows with corrupt regimes, that could become more and more attractive. And it could actually supplant the dollar and it could supplant the U.S. as the leading trading power. And when the rest of the world sees the dynamism of growth of the Russian Empire, growth of the Chinese Empire, they're going to be very cautious then. It's not as if, you know, everything is a steady state except for that. Like every other country in the world, Pakistan, India, Central Asia, African states, our European allies even, are going to be watching and saying, well, we don't want to get trampled and we don't want to get on the wrong side of where things are headed. So they're going to start hedging their bets. So the world deteriorates quickly for the U.S. if we see the rise of authoritarian empires and the decline of democratic market systems.
And I mentioned before, and you just touched on it again, the U.S. dollar is the reserve currency for the world. Maybe just give people, a lot of people say, well, I don't know what that means. I mean, it means I can go to Paris and use dollars? What does that mean? It's important in a lot of ways.
What it means is that all of the major economies in the world, when they trade with each other, account it in dollars. And they hold dollars in their central bank accounts in order to finance the trade. That means that the U.S. dollar is important to everybody. It means that the U.S. is able to effectively go into massive budget deficits, print money.
Without a run on the bond.
Everybody depends upon the stability of the dollar. If people move away from that, and the demand for the dollar is shrinking dramatically at some point, we're going to have a huge problem with all of this money that we put out there that is now worth less and less.
Right. And as a tool of statecraft, if the dollar is a reserve currency, you have some clout short of the use of force of arms through sanctions, you have a lot less if people aren't trading in your currency anymore.
I mean, Americans have been in love with sanctions since the 18th century, not necessarily with always, you know, glowing results, but the fondness for using sanctions as an alternative to using military force has a long history in the United States. And obviously, if you don't have control of the world's currency, then sanctions become much less effective.
Yeah. Edward Luce is a journalist. He's a very good journalist. I don't always agree with Edward Luce, but he said that the invasion of Ukraine is a serious threat to the international order because, quote, should Putin succeed, it would legitimize the law of the jungle, where large countries can annex smaller ones with impunity. And by the way, it's also important that what Putin and Xi are both saying is not, well, we're breaking the law, but so what? That would be an interesting way they could, but they're not. What they're saying instead is, no, you don't understand. Ukraine doesn't really exist. It's part of Russia. It's a rogue province, essentially. We're going to make them submit as they should because they've run away. Xi Jinping says Taiwan is part of China. Historically, that's by no means always been the case. Plenty of Taiwanese do not see themselves as at all Chinese. But that's what he's saying. He's, I'm not conquering a separate nation. It's a rogue province. It's what Saddam was saying instead about Kuwait. And it's what the regime in Tehran would say, wouldn't they, about Bahrain, for example. No, it's a rogue province. So they're saying, in other words, the point I'm trying to make is they're not saying there's no international law. They're saying you interpret international law one way. We interpret it another way. I think our interpretation is better. I think I can convince most people that that's the case.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, to be frank, I mean, they're just demonstrating that, you know, brute force in the end wins. And I would say Ukraine has even should have greater prominence because it is a direct threat at the West. And if Russia can figure out a way to recoup from its disastrous performance so far and actually end up crushing Ukraine, then I think the ripple effect of that through the West, the ripple effect on the it's not just a ripple, it'll be a tidal wave against the United States because the United States has staked its credibility at stopping the Russians in Ukraine. And if we prove that we can't do that, if the other, our NATO partners prove that they can't do that, then I think NATO has lost all credibility.
All right, let's talk about NATO for a minute, Mr. Ambassador. I think it's – because right now even a lot of the isolationists or neo-isolationists are saying, look, Ukraine's not part of NATO. We shouldn't be defending it. We've spent enough on it, whatever. But we sure will defend NATO. Oh, no, that we have to defend. And I can see them changing that argument by the following logic. Let's suppose another, scenario. Putin more or less wins in Ukraine. Belarus is, I would say, already a vassal state. He could make it part of the Russian Federation if he wants to, but it may not be. It's not necessarily convenient for him. It's no threat. It's not a democracy. But nonetheless, he could say, you know what I really need? I need a land bridge into Kaliningrad, which is, for people who don't know, a Russian territory not contiguous. It used to be Konigsberg. It was German. They took it over. Emanuel Kant. So they took it over, and it is the naval base for Russia in the Baltic Sea. So how would you get a land bridge? Well, very simple. You go through Belarus, which is a vassal state or part, whatever it is. And then Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania, is very near the border. You could take that in a day or so. That's not like taking Kyiv. It's much easier. And then I've looked at the maps. There's a road from Vilnius right to – all you need to do is take southern Lithuania, and now you have a land bridge. Now, if Americans don't want to sacrifice even money, not blood, just treasure – to protect Ukraine, are you really going to get Americans to say, oh, yes, we have to spill blood to save southern Lithuania? Really? Well, it's part of NATO. Yeah, so what? Why would we? I think that would be a hard argument for a president to make. Yes, we're sending our troops over to liberate southern Lithuania.
Right. Well, this is a great question, Cliff, because it starts bringing up all of these fundamentals about how you have a world that is good for the United States or a world where the U.S. is at threat or at risk or losing its interests, possibly even having to fight for our own well-being. So the first thing is, if we don't defend a NATO ally who is attacked, then all of NATO unravels and everybody can be attacked. So you can't let that first bit of territory go. as much as you're right that people will look at it and say, it's not that important, or it's, Russians have a reason, or is it really worth American lives for southern Lithuania? But the reality is, if you don't do it, then it's just like Hitler in the 30s. You know, that's just the first thing, and it's going to happen again and again. And the Lithuanians, they have militias. They have distributed weapons to their population. They will be fighting, and it'll get messy, and we will get dragged into a worse war. So we just have to be upfront. Unacceptable. We will fight and try to deter that from ever happening.
But if I'm the devil's advocate, I'm going to say to you, and I'm this isolationist, you know what? NATO had its time, but I don't. I mean, really, do we really want to fight for Lithuania? Do we really want to fight? I mean, and of course, by that point, Putin may have taken Moldova, because that's really low hanging. It's not. NATO.
I would extend that. I mean, I that's why I think the China first conservatives lack all credibility, because the notion that if somehow the United States isn't going to fight for Europe. That Eastern Europe isn't really the a primary area of American concern, and we're going to go to war over Taiwan, which we are culturally much further from. I just find it absurd. I think it's something that is thrown out there. There was a book put out years ago by Ross Douthat where more or less said that, you know, America has to get its priorities straight. We need to pick. We can't fight everywhere. And I think the response to that is that, well, just pick one spot that you're really, really willing to fight other than Canada. And I just don't trust those that – I mean, it should be prima facie that you have to stop Putin in Ukraine. It just should be a given.
And if you're not
and if you're not willing to go through that ratiocination and come up with a yes there, I just don't think you can go through another reasoning and come up with, oh, yeah, I'm going to have Americans die over Taiwan. I don't think it works.
And she, it seems to me, will take that lesson clearly. He'll see it that way too. Yeah. But and it's also problematic for this reason, it seems to me. President Biden has said three or four times, I forget how many, that he wants to defend Taiwan and would, right? And then it's been walked back by his staff. Well, we mean strategic ambiguity. We don't know if we would, but he keeps saying it to make him look, you know, like a tough guy. The problem is, from what I understand from war games run, including by FDD's own retired Admiral Mark Montgomery, it is not clear that we can defeat China in a war over Taiwan. And if we do, it would be a tremendous cost in lives and ships and aircraft. I mean, this is not like we don't have deterrence by denial here where she says, I can't manage that. He could think, you know what? I think I got a 50-50 chance, and I think I've got more lives to spare than the Americans do. So let's just go for it. I'm not among those praising Biden for saying we're going to do it, because if you will the end, you must will the means. And he's not. He's cutting the Navy. You don't cut the Navy when you say I'm going to send our Navy to war over Taiwan, which by the way, has no Zelensky in the sense that, I mean, Zelensky is a very good salesman to the world.
I think we can sum it up. Our defense spending is not credible.
Right.
It does not match our rhetoric. Kurt, you were about ready to say something there.
Yeah, no, I was going to say something in a different direction. I agree with what you said just now, but we also have to remember, you know, who's in NATO and who's not in NATO, or where the lines of NATO are. NATO was created because we had democracies in Europe that wanted to band together to make sure that nobody attacked them, because we had just been through a world war, and it was launched by Germany and the Soviet Union swallowing up vulnerable countries. And there were, you know, unprovoked attacks against Belgium and France and unprovoked attacks against Poland. And this was a way for those who were left standing to get together and say, not again. Well, everybody feels this way. The Poles feel this way. The Baltic states feel this way. And now the Ukrainians feel this way, saying, look, we got our independence back finally in 1991, and now the Russians are trying to take it away from us again. We need to be banding together. So when people say, well, who's a member of NATO? Should Ukraine be a member of NATO, or should it not be a member of NATO? We'll defend this one and not that one. We're losing track of what the whole purpose of this is. The whole purpose is for states that share a common set of democratic values to be together and protect themselves against outside authoritarians who want to trample them. And Ukraine is actually the poster child of this right now and absolutely should be brought into NATO as soon as it is feasible to do so.
So two questions, and maybe these are my last, but other points you want to make, I'm happy to have you make them. One is what you just said about the importance of NATO. That's, it seems to me that whoever is president should be making that case, and we haven't had a president making, the current president is. I don't think Trump did either. But if NATO is important to the United States, our political leaders need to explain why to people in a way you are, but our leadership is not. Secondly, if you were ambassador to NATO right now, would it not be a part of your job to say to the Germans, to say to the French, guys, you got to step up. You can't just expect the Americans forever to do what they have been doing for you and say, yeah, that's our job. We're your gendarmerie. You cannot. No, you guys have to do
it. No, but one, I'd let Kurt go on there, but I just say you have to be very careful with that because that you get into this sort of quid pro quo slippery slope where you're in fact saying that NATO is a transactional relationship. The United States is in Europe because, period, it's in America's interest to be in Europe. We are there because we should be a European power. Full stop. Second issue is, yes, it would be better. I'm not sure if I want to see the Germans become more powerful, but yes,
I want more money.
I want to see other Europeans, at least get to the 2% mark. Americans have been after that for a very, very long time. I'm sure Kurt had long discussions about that when he was at NATO. I want to see that, but that doesn't negate. It doesn't influence the first argument. And that is, even if they don't do that, NATO is in our national interest. We should be a European power regardless of what they spend.
But you still have to say to the Europeans, sure, make this job easier for me, not harder. But right? And here's how you do it, guys.
Yes, yes. But I'd be careful of the linkage.
I hear you. Yeah. Kurt, all the last words are yours.
I totally agree with Ruel on that. I think that, yes, you do have to keep pushing the French and the Germans and others all the time to carry their share of the burden, no question. And every administration has done this. And it would be a big part of what to do now. And as Ruel says, it doesn't mean that we should pull back if they don't, because it's in our interest to be there anyway. But the other thing that I think is sometimes lost on people, and seems to be the last few administrations in particular, is that this stuff only works if the U.S. leads.
Absolutely.
That we will get more out of our European allies if we are willing to put our money on the table and say we're doing it. And that's not just about the money. It's about the belief of what's going to work or not. No one would be giving aid to Ukraine today at all. And no one would be, buying these arms and giving them to the Ukrainians if the U.S. was not doing it. They'd be saying, well, shoot, I don't want to pick a fight with Russia. They're big. I'm small. I'm going to be cautious here. The fact that the U.S. is willing to give aid to the Ukrainians is exactly what's necessary for the Germans and the Spanish and others to give them tanks and for the French to give them air defense systems and so on. So U.S. leadership means an awful lot. And that's how you get the most out of the Europeans. By showing you're willing to lead, you create a space for them to do more too.
I said last question, but this occurs to me. It's just an irony, is it not, that if Putin totally fails in Ukraine, there'll be less need and less enthusiasm in NATO than if he, if Putin wins even a little bit, every NATO member is going to be on guard and say, we better be careful that it doesn't get any further. So we're going to reinforce our allegiance and our participation in NATO. But if he totally fails, they can say, okay, yeah, Russia's no longer a problem. China's America's problem. We can go back to selling Mercedes to people around the world.
Well, yes. Putin has an uncanny knack for producing exactly the opposite of what he wants.
Yeah. Well, I would be thrilled to listen to conversations in Brussels about the dangers of Russia cracking up. So would that scenario could arrive that we could actually have those discussions about the implosion of Russia after the fall of Putin.
By the way, if there's an implosion of Russia after the fall of Putin, Xi Jinping benefits. Because I guarantee you, Xi Jinping does not think Vladivostok, which literally translates as ruler of the East, and was annexed by Russia from China, I think around 1860. I don't think he necessarily sees that as a forever status quo. So, and there's a lot of areas that are very lightly populated in what we call the Russian East, which is really the east of the Russian Empire, that China could expand its population in. Not that its population is expanding, but it's still a lot bigger population than Russia has.
Great point. And I think that underscores what we were talking about earlier with the liberal economic order. If we look at this just through the prism of China, Russia getting together and, you know, helping each other on Ukraine and Taiwan, we're missing the point. China's ambitions are far bigger than that, and they're global. And Russia can join that order if it wants to or not. China would be happy if they did, but it's all about China. It's not about Russia.
Ambassador Volker, thank you so much. It's just fun and interesting and entertaining and edifying to talk to you. So again, my thanks.
Yeah, well, thank you guys. Very, very good to be here.
Thanks, Rael. Always fun to talk to you. And thanks to all of you who joined us today for this conversation here on Foreign Policy.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Foreign Policy. If you enjoyed the show, please rate us, preferably with 5 stars. Ratings and reviews help give us visibility and the opportunity to reach more people who seek to understand the most critical national security and foreign policy issues. Also, make sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Follow FDD on social media and visit our website at fdd.org. There you can find research by FDD experts, you can subscribe to all FDD's products, you can catch up on any past episodes you may have missed. Finally, we'd love your feedback, your ideas, your questions, your criticisms. Send us an email at foreignpodacy@fdd.org. Until next time, I'm Cliff May. And you've been listening to Foreign Policy.